Good evening. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. This is tape number 395, June 29th, 1979, in the side one of that tape. I started the tape last week with some comments about the CIA pilfering the files of the House Select Committee on the assassinations, and I want to make a few more comments about that. I just briefly talked about it at the beginning of tape number 394. For those of you who don't have that tape, there was an article across the wire services. It was pretty well covered in the country, different versions of it, of how the House Select Committee on Assassinations last July caught an agent from the Central Intelligence Agency going through their files and exhibits and documents on the Kennedy assassination. The Washington Post had quite a long article, longer than the first one that we got out here, the CIA rifling of the Congressional Committee's files, and the article says that they were aimed at getting the CIA off the hook, that they were looking through the documentation and they were investigating it to see what they could get out of it for themselves. Interesting comment by Mr. Lardner in the Washington Post. G. Robert Blakey, the chief investigator of the House Select Committee on Assassinations, said, this is a quotation, "The one thing that would have done us in, the House Select Committee on Assassinations, would have been for those photos of John Kennedy to be publicly released. We were never satisfied that someone else wasn't involved." Now, that's an interesting statement for G. Robert Blakey, who did such a good work of covering up who killed the President of the United States and who killed Martin Luther King, that at this stage of the game, coming out in June of 1979 and saying we were never satisfied that someone else wasn't involved. The article went on to say that the most sensitive files were rifled and the circumstantial evidence was overwhelming that there was more than a curiosity. The original cover-up by Mr. Turner of the CIA was that there was a curiosity on a particular guard to take a peek at the information, but the later articles said that the CIA officer went into a room. He wasn't supposed to be there. He opened a safe. He pulled out a drawer. He took out a ring binder notebook from the drawer. He ripped open a plastic case from the notebook. He took pictures of the contents out of the plastic case, and the original charge of just being curious is hardly able to describe the situation of what he was doing. It's similar to Watergate burglary, breaking into the Democratic headquarters and taking pictures of information inside their files. The CIA has been accused of conducting a short-sighted, self-protective investigation of the Kennedy assassination. Mr. Blakey retorted with that and said if it was just curiosity, why didn't the agent just look at the photos? Why did he have to take pictures of them? The safe also contained that controversial magic bullet that was supposed to have gone through the body of John Kennedy and John Connally and came out pristine. That was among the evidence that was locked up. The autopsy photographs of the headshot that killed John Kennedy were taken out of the slip cases. They were, in quotes, left disarray inside the three-drawer safe. The CIA agent was given a lie detector test and asked if he was ordered into the safe, and he failed that answer. Robert Blakey has revealed that after July, when the gentleman from the CIA was caught in the files, it gave him more leverage for information on Lee Harvey Oswald and the assassination, and that the CIA then coughed up information about Oswald and his visit to Mexico in September of 1963. Well, if they gave it anything to Robert Blakey, they certainly didn't share it with the American people, because that's still a hushed-up area, as are all the other areas that they went into. Mr. Blakey says that after they caught the CIA pilfering and photographing, there was a marked improvement of their relationships, and he got, in quotes, everything we wanted. Well, he never wanted very much from the beginning, so I guess he got what he wanted. The CIA didn't offer much, and Blakey didn't ask for much. There were several people that they were going to test or ask about whether they ordered this agent in. One is CIA Deputy Director Frank Carlucci, but I don't know if he was given a polygraph test. I doubt it. And then there's another one, Scott Breckinridge, a CIA from the Inspector General's office. He was a liaison to the Senate committee in 1975-76 that was investigating the CIA with Senator Church. And, of course, Mr. Breckinridge's average of batting out people that whose names could be on those sheets of paper was pretty good. Right after the testimony of Sheffield Edwards, he died, William Harvey died, John Rosselli died, Sam Giancana never testified. William Sullivan of Division 5 of the FBI died. A large number of the assassination team, George de Morenschild, Carlos Prio Siqueiros, there was a whole rash of deaths around the time of the Senate intelligence investigation. And there was some suspicion that maybe Scott Breckinridge, the inspector general, had sent this agent in to photograph or snoop around or whether blackmail purposes or plant evidence inside the House Select Committee files. For whatever reasons, they were photographing and they weren't supposed to be in there. And the CIA was caught surreptitiously pulling another type of Watergate operation that they're not supposed to be doing, particularly since the files go back to the CIA anyway. I don't know why they had to do it at the time. It seems that they were playing games with G. Robert Blakey. But in any event, in their desperation to see what was going on, they had to break into the offices. And I just thought I'd add this little bit of information to what we had last week. The 1980 elections are getting started with a bang bang and almost a death of another candidate. Jimmy Carter has survived two assassination attempts so far. Ted Kennedy was almost killed on an aeroplane, a plane that crashed in Cape Cod, flight 248, described June the 18th, 1979. A pilot was killed and nine survive a Massachusetts plane crash. The airline said that Senator Ed Kennedy had been on board the scheduled flight immediately preceding this one, and the plane that crashed was the one that he had taken the last weekend that goes evidently from Hyannisport back to Washington or New York City. It's a short flight. It's one that he takes frequently, particularly in the summer. Everything was peeled off the plane, and if it had caught fire, nobody would have survived. Nine victims went to Cape Cod Hospital. The pilot is dead. He was Air New England senior pilot and vice president of the company, and according to the newspaper reports, everything was normal until the crash. Ted Kennedy survived a airplane crash in 1964 with serious back injuries, but he almost got it this time. Reminds me of Lieutenant Merv Dimely, Lieutenant Governor Merv Dimely of California, taking a Sunday plane when he was scheduled for a Monday morning that went into San Diego with a fatal plane crash took place last September. So Ted Kennedy, I'm sure, got a message on that one and a close call, but that seems to be par for the course for elections. Now, one of the most dangerous men running for office, I think it's a toss-up with Reagan managed by Paul Exalt, with the Howard Hughes Summa Power Corporation behind that till, and Mr. Bush, who was director of the CIA under Gerald Ford, John Connally, Secretary of the Treasury, Secretary of the Navy, up to his ears with information on the Kennedy assassination and the Tyrol Bay complex of Permandex, traveling around with that kind of intellectual baggage. And along with those candidates, there's General Haig, who retired from NATO today. And he's supposed to have had a car crash, very interesting car crash. I call it the launching of his political career. Haig jumped 30 or 40 positions in the Army. He was handpicked by Henry Kissinger in the Chase Manhattan Bilderberger Society. He's been the head of NATO, the darling of that clique in the East, and, of course, running for dictator of the world in 1980. If he could make it, he would love it. And what better way to announce his political career than what Adolf Hitler used, a little Reichstag violence to come down on the terrorists. He got through this car accident in which nobody was hurt. Nobody went to a hospital. Everybody was cleared. He got immediate media attention. He got the best publicity he could get. He came on in sympathy because he was the victim of a near assassination attack, like Gerald Ford was with Sarah Moore and Squeaky Fromm. You notice that the right wing, the extreme right wing, never dies. You don't see anybody shooting Ronald Reagan or Evel Young or Ed Davis or people like Haig or Connally. They don't die. It's only the left or the center left or the peacemakers that die. these guys seem to walk away from it, and then he has this Me Too, the terrorists after Me Too. First headlines from Haig were, General Haig escapes terrorist bombing. Another one, General Haig escapes mystery blast in Belgium. Another one, Haig narrowly escapes attempt to murder him. He came out and said it was a landmine, and then he says, gosh, it was a close one. He uses the word gosh, and he described the rear of his car that was damaged, and he said, I feel that I was the target of a specific organization, but he couldn't make any clues, and there were no arrests. That was the first day's reportage. The second day got a little more interesting. By June the 27th, this is one headline, slow start in probe on attempt to kill Haig. I asked, why the slow start? Why not jump out after them? They said something, the detonation went off, you could run after them. I'm afraid they don't want to arrest their own, and the headline was saying, to find a suspect, it will take a long time, and they're going to have a slow time finding it. The quotation was, the investigation will be long and difficult. Another quotation, the bomb didn't bear the readily identifiable signature of any one of the major terrorist groups. Of course not. Not if it's an agent provocateur and the other terrorists would deny it, and they had to come up with the evidence. The officials were reserved, according to one article, and said the attack had several confusing aspects. There isn't anything confusing when you think of the way that political campaigns through the media and through the use of these bombs are very effective, or these near-death scares of people on the right. The article on the slow start of the probe said that other passengers were not hurt. There were no notes claiming responsibility, and the bomb was described as a curious mixture of professional and primitive. They'll say some guerrillas did it. It was so primitive. The investigation of the, in quotes, mystery blast will take a long time because they'll have to come up with an answer. If it isn't an agent provocateur, a Reichstag kind of phony baloney, here's me, I'm running, look, they're trying to kill me, but I won't be afraid, I'm coming home, and I've withstood the fires of near death. That's General Haig's entree into the American presidential election, and I'm sure that he'll keep it up, and he won't be killed, and he'll be strong and alive like all the other people running right alongside of him. Another article, the New York Times, and this is important, begins headlines, quotes, investigators lack clear clues in bomb attack on Haig. American officials said there were many unanswered questions about the method of attack. There's speculations that persons or a group of unknown to the anti-terrorist forces could have been responsible for the attack. The police have examined the worker's helmet and a vacuum bottle near the bomb site, but haven't indicated they found any fingerprints. The next thing I expect to find is a letter from the SLA, a new unknown terrorist group that has come from nowhere and has jeopardized the great General Haig. Another note on the 1980 elections, this is the Washington Post, June 24, 1979, if Reagan would accept GOP vice president nomination. You bet he would accept the vice president. He's plenty sorry he didn't do it last time, and I don't think Gerry Ford would have selected him, because Ford knew then if they both won, Ford would be killed. It would have been another John Kennedy Lyndon Johnson combination, and Ford, as I've said on other tapes before, was up all night and made the final decision. He would take Dole even if he lost, and that certainly was a wise decision. Now Ronald Reagan is coming out and saying that, yes, he'd take the second chance, Senate nomination in 1980 under Senator Howard Baker, John Connally, or George Bush. All those three men from the Central Intelligence Agency and Luxalt running Reagan's campaign from the CIA. So you really are getting every single candidate has been with the CIA and has worked himself up to become president of the United States. Reagan said that he'll be glad to be vice president, and if the occasion comes, he wouldn't turn it down. If something were to happen, he would fill the bill. He said, I don't want the job, but if it was a call to duty and you felt you could help, I don't know anyone who could refuse it. This is a guy that's been trained and feathered and propped up with the publicity and the pancake. His face must be peeling off with pancake and layers of makeup, running for this presidency for years. The grooming of Ronald Reagan parallels the grooming of Richard Nixon. And with such modesty, he says, I don't know anyone who could refuse it. So he will take second position and then help the guy who gets on top, because I still feel that Reagan can work his way in, whether it's through bullets or blackmail. If he takes a second position, he'll be president someday. There was an article in the Washington Post this week. I don't know how many of you read the Post, so I think it's very important to quote the sources. And it has to do with a subject I've talked about many times before, my friend Adolf Hitler. It has to do with that great Nazi, Gustav Franz Wagner, who's 68 years old, and the Brazilian court decided that they wouldn't extradite Wagner for trials in four countries. He came to Brazil with Franz Stengel in the 1950s. He was commanding officer in the Sobibor and Treblinka concentration camps, and the Brazilian police have protected him. Mr. Wagner was photographed April 1978, and for those of you that have these earlier tapes from a year ago, I think I've talked about this since May of 1978, that a photographer took a scene of the what they call the neo-Nazi, but it's a continuation of the regular Nazis. There's a neo-Nazi Congress that meets every year, and according to the Washington Post, it was held in Brazil to celebrate the birthday of Adolf Hitler. Now, they didn't say to celebrate the birthday of the late Adolf Hitler. This party's been written up many times. I was told by two sources close to the Central Intelligence Agency in Argentina and in Brazil, two times last year, one towards the end of the year and one shortly after, around May or June of 1978, I was told, it may be wrong, that Hitler attended that party. But somebody took a picture of Mr. Wagner, and he went immediately to the Brazilian police, and he said, protect me. And they have protected him. I was told by these sources, those were my sources, that Hitler had gone to a sanitarium in Switzerland, that he didn't go back to Argentina after the pictures were taken. Wagner realized what happened when his picture was recognized, and he went to the police for protection. And some of you don't believe it, and it doesn't matter whether you believe it or not. I'm just going to pass it on for the records that I was told at that point that Adolf went on to Switzerland, where he's in a sanitarium at the present time. Wagner is known as a human beast. He never denied his place in the extermination camps, and he's accused of causing the death of more than 1 million people. Now, four countries allegedly wanted him, and there are four countries that were given excuses for not releasing him. Incidentally, he came to Brazil and worked for the Volkswagen Motor Company and has a high position and is very wealthy and works, I believe, in the Volkswagen Motor Car Company. I read just yesterday or 2 days ago that they're trying to buy Chrysler Corporation in the United States. Four countries were supposed to ask for him. Israel, they turned them down. They said, you can't have him because your war crimes were committed before 1948, and you didn't become a country until 48, therefore you can't have him to try him. Austria, you can't have him because you stripped him of his citizenship after the war and said he's no longer a citizen. Poland, where the Treblinka and Sobibor concentration camps are, on Polish soil, they said you can't have him because there was a deficiency in your extradition papers filed by the Polish government. Because there was a deficiency. That's like a weak prosecution of Dan White or of John Mitchell or Murray Stans or John Connolly. The Polish government didn't ask very hard, and their presentation was so poor. Ask the Polish Pope about that one. The deficiency in their extradition papers means they would not return to Poland, and their excuse for not returning them to Germany was that they cited the statute of limitations had run out. Now, it was my opinion that the statutes run out in December of 79. This is June 1979, but this is double talk. It doesn't make sense, but those are the reasons that four countries couldn't have him, and now he's back on his estate doing business as usual. This is the man from Treblinka concentration camps who accepts the responsibility for a million or more murders and torture and so forth of these various people. But the Brazilian government intends to keep him there, and every year there's been a reunion of those Nazis, and next year the statute of limitations is over. The new president of Germany is a Nazi, and they will be home, and nobody will be punished. They will be protected with watchdogs and security guards all of their lives. Last week, I talked about alternative tape, alternative three on tape number 395, but I didn't have space on the paper and the sheet that it goes with the tape. I gave a long sheet because there was too much material to get onto the shorter sheet, and I'm going to do it again this week, because just as I gave you my classification files for Jonestown, I'm giving you these sections that I'm breaking the space articles that I have into, where I can keep some eye on what is going on with the satellite space shuttles and see if we can break open this document called Alternative 3 and find out what parts of it are true or untrue. Bob Treber, a radio announcer on KGO, tried all last week to get in touch with Judrell Bank and find out whether Sir William Ballantyne actually worked there before. That's a famous institution in Great Britain for astronomers studying astronomy, and those are the foremost experts in the world, just about. And on the evening of the 24th of June, he spoke to a Mr. T.W. Rackham at Jodrell Bank and asked if there was a Sir William Ballantyne who worked there as an astronomer, because of the allegations in this book that Ballantyne worked there and had been killed in a car crash, and we're trying to find these people and say, no, the book is hogwash, or part of it is true, or all of it's true, because we don't know. So Mr. Rackham answered the telephone at Jodrell Bank and said, I can't answer you. I can't give out any information without the approval of my superiors. Call back Tuesday, because Bob's on the air at 1 in the morning, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday out here on the West Coast from 1 to 5. So Tuesday, Monday afternoon, I called Bob Treber at his home around 5 p.m., and he said, I'll be talking to Jodrell Bank this evening or early morning at 1 a.m. and find out about Alternative 3, whether it's fiction or not. And he said, I'll be on the air. They'll be on the air early this morning. It's afternoon over in England, and you listen. So I stayed up, anxious to know if the book Alternative 3 is fiction or nonfiction. Because when I publish articles, I have to give documentation and back up the allegations I make, and I thought that Avon Press would check these out. So I stayed up, and there wasn't anything mentioned about Jodrell Bank, and Bob wasn't able to get in touch with him. But the next evening, he did get in touch with him, and he got them on the telephone in England, and they told him that there was no Sir William Ballantyne. They never heard of Ballantyne, but they would not go on the air. Nobody could be interviewed, and they were not allowed to discuss the matter. That kind of unnerved Bob Treber, because I think he wanted to believe the book is fiction, and he wanted them to categorically get on the air and be identified and denounce the book. But there are faceless people, voiceless people, who would not allow themselves to be taped or quoted, said they don't know Ballantyne, but there is no way that they could get on the air and say that the statements they were making then were in fact the truth. Alternative 3 is available in the bookstores, and Tom Davis has it out here at Research. You have the address. I've given it on a lot of the other sheets before, and I'll give it one more time if you want to order it from him. I'm not saying the book is factual, but I want to find out if space stations exist, if they're planning genocide or slave labor, or if 90% of the population is anticipated to be shipped up there. I want to know, and I have a right to know, and particularly with Nazi scientists working with the CIA, I have a right to know how much of this book is true, and I'm not going to be put down by these particular people that say, avoid this, don't get into it. I want to know, and the more evasive they are, the more angry I get. I've faced famous denials. I've heard J. Edgar Hoover say that Lee Harvey Oswald killed John Kennedy, and that those people that questioned it were crazy. We're used to the Attorney General lying under oath. We're used to the President of the United States lying under oath. And I'm not going to accept a faceless, voiceless person telling Bob Treber he doesn't know who Ballantyne was, but he can't give his name. The chief at Jodrell Bank can't give their name, can't go on the air, and can't denounce a book which is sold as nonfiction. Their silence is worse these nameless people are eerie. I think they're eerie, and I think Bob had the same feeling. I think we have to get to the responsibility of this matter, and this week I called Nancy Neiman at Avon Press. I tried to get her last week, and I haven't had any satisfaction. And this involves a very difficult question for researchers. Are fiction books sold as nonfiction? Where do we get our truth? Because we assume that some of this is checked out. The publishers and legal department check this out. If people are going to do research and the books that they use as source information are really fiction, sold as nonfiction, is there any responsibility for the book publishers? Is there any responsibility if I quote them and get sued? I think we have a right to know who has control of our facts. This is very basic to the future investigative journalism and playing with our minds to know whether these are facts or fiction. It's a very important point. I think of George Orwell in 1984. He wrote, "If thoughts corrupt language, language also corrupts thoughts." And there were some quotations from Oceana that maybe are worth repeating when we talk about this. Orwell said, "The key to Oceania's control of its population is the manipulation of its language. Speech has been deliberately debased to the point where it's meaningless. To prevent unorthodox thoughts from entering the minds of party members, a completely new language is created to make political heresy impossible." At Jodrell Bank, they said, "There is no Sir William Sullivan, but we're not allowed to answer your questions. We're not allowed to make comments." And Orwell said, "Newspeak was created, or will be created, to make political heresy impossible due to the lack of words to convey unsanctioned ideas." Newspeak makes political heresy impossible due to a lack of words. You can't find these people if they won't come forward and say something, but they control your thinking, because if you question them, they can call you paranoid or off on a limb. But they won't stand up and take a position and defend their position. And Orwell said that Newspeak is, quotes, "created to make political heresy impossible due to the lack of words to convey an unsanctioned idea. The ability to believe two contradictory statements simultaneously without perceiving the illogic inherent in such a position." What we're getting here are two contradictory statements, or tantamount to that, without perceiving the illogic inherent in such a position. When they say there is no Sir William Valentine, they should just look you in the face and say there's no Sir William Valentine. But when they say we have orders not to talk about it and we can't get on the air, it's similar to Richard Nixon getting on national television and saying, "Let me make this perfectly clear," and then he lies at the press conference. He makes it perfectly clear, and then he tells a lie. That's the kind of reaction that's coming out of Jodrell Bank in England, which, as I say, arouses my curiosity and anger at the same time. I'm going to do the remaining side of this tape and the other side on a continuation of some things that I didn't get on the last tape on Alternative 3. I want to talk about a sickening prospect with you. I'm going to ask questions of this one. I don't know the answer, but I'm going to tell you my worst thoughts about it and share them with you and explain why I feel this way about it. There have been many articles about people who've been abducted by UFOs, by so-called alien creatures. They're all taken immediately to doctors for hypnosis to remember what they saw in case they forgot the details. Their description of the people that they see are very similar all around the world. There was a recent article that just came out about a couple that was examined by alien creatures. This was a few years ago, actually, John and Sue Day. They described pink-eyed humanoids. Some were 7 feet tall. Some were squat, ugly aliens, short ones. And they had humanoid characteristics. They didn't talk. There were 3 short, ugly people, 3 feet tall. And then, as I say, these older people with the pink eyes, described as pink eyes, no eyelids. People all over the world are seeing these beings with no eyelids, very tight skin, pale skin, and they don't speak to the people, but they communicate in whatever way, or with their mannerisms or their hands, and seem to direct them. And the a lot of the people who've seen them are followed by what they call the black men that come to the house, remove things from the home, and take away traces or evidence of these visits. On the other side of this tape, I'm going to share with you my opinion about what is happening to these creatures, and it's a pretty sickening idea, but I guess it's time that we face the worst and throw it out and just share it with each other and talk about it. One of my worst fears is that what if these people are genetically mutilated? What if they are humanoids that have been tampered with and are being used for purposes of terror or development for outer space? What if that were happening? Or is it happening?